You're listening to Unpaused, a podcast for women who want to stage a career comeback or mastermind a new one after an extended break from work. I'm your host, Judy Stewart, and if you want to reclaim your career but don't know how, then this is the podcast for you. Let's meet our guest for today. Today I'm talking to Sky Gingell, the Australian cook whose vision has made Spring Restaurant a culinary landmark in London. There are so many reasons I wanted to interview Sky for Unpaused. For one, her culinary signature was built up day in, day out, by staying close to her most closely held beliefs. These beliefs represent the consistent theme that fused the links of her career chain. Sky would become a standard bearer for the use of seasonal ingredients grown biodynamically by dedicated growers, and cooked and presented creatively at their natural peak. In this way, her elegant salon-style restaurant in London's frenetic West End is still able to be anchored firmly in the English countryside. Her story is not without its ups and downs, with several pauses and some serious setbacks. But the woman you'll hear has determinedly held true to her beliefs, done the hard work, all the while feeding her imagination and managing to keep that first spark of her love of cooking alive, which I love. When the time came to make a move, somehow opportunities came her way. She's not done yet. I see a third chapter starting to take shape, with Sky emerging as something of an activist. Sky says, even though she sees herself in the third and final phase of her career, she still wants to be in the middle of the bed. How she got there, what still excites her, and what saved her in the dark days is all here in her story. Here she is.
I feel that I'm in a really nice part of my working life where I feel energized. I feel like some of the things that were really important to me even 10 years ago, which were probably more ego-driven than they are now, was my own personal work in the kitchen. And I think now that I am really interested in many more things to do with food in many ways. I feel a very, very strong sense that I'm in the last third of my working life, and that has prompted me in probably the last 3 or 4 years to look at when I finish my working life and I look back on it, I want to feel like I've contributed something positive to the industry that I work in.
If I focused at first instance on sort of the business card, the Sky, you've had two really big roles so far in your professional life. If you were to describe those two roles, just to give some idea of where you've come from in this long evolution to being quite a famous culinary figure in London now?
Well, I suppose the first role that you were talking about is opening Petersham Nurseries in 2004. And that was something that I really fell into by accident. I was 38 years of age. I'd been working in the food industry already for about 19 years at that stage.
So you trained formally as a chef?
I did. I got a job washing up in a kitchen when I was 18 years of age. I worked for a really wonderful woman called Leila Sorfi, who I absolutely attribute my falling in love to food with. She was an incredible mentor.
So you weren't someone who made a cake every Saturday afternoon?
No.
It just happened at 18?
Well, I grew up in a house that, interestingly, and I don't think anyone would be offended by me saying this, is we grew up in a house that became macrobiotic when my father was 41 or 42. Mm-hmm. And so our whole way of eating changed, and food was incredibly important in our house, but it wasn't delicious. But when I first got the job, I started Sydney University, and I got this job working at the store in Double Bay. And Leila was just this person who probably saw someone who was not particularly confident, quite vulnerable, didn't sail through her teenage years, you know, like
everybody else.
Like everybody else, or how it seemed everybody else did. And she really stood next to me. And in the afternoon, when we'd finish the busy lunch rush, she'd say, would you like to come and stand next to me and make mayonnaise? Or, I'm just going to make a chicken stock now. Do you want to come and do it with me? And that kind of nurturing and kind of quiet support really allowed me to just kind of feel safe and confident. And I absolutely adored every moment of it. And I then went on to train in Paris, and I went to a school called La Varenne. And I went to the school because Layla had been there. So mm-hmm. I wanted to do everything that Layla
she
had done.
Yeah.
And I left university, and my parents were not pleased. And I think the idea of me being a cook seemed absurd to them. You know, this was 1980.
Yeah.
But they kind of indulged me and let me go. And I've never looked back, really.
But you did it properly. Like, by going to La Varenne and Anne Willen and all of that, you did it in the best possible way that you could have done it, didn't you?
I think so, although I think I probably wasn't thinking. Looking back is such an incredible thing over your life after a certain age, isn't it? I think I just wanted to be Layla. And actually, when I finished, I got a terrible shock because I worked at a restaurant called Dodin Buffon in Paris for 18 months, and then I came to London and I worked at the Dorchester. And it was not the world I thought it was. It was kind of stainless steel. It was neon strip lighting. It was really long hours. It was a kind of very male-dominated world. You know, I spent 3-4 years in restaurants, and I absolutely hated every minute of it. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't cooking in the way that I'd fallen in love with it with Layla. Mm-hmm. So a lot of my work life has been, how do I make the environment where I first fell in love with food? A, because that's the place I want to work. I don't want to work in a big Western kitchen with lots of shouting and drama and anger. I want to work in an environment that's really beautiful, with produce that's inspiring, where people kind of feel safe and confident and can... I always think it was... For me, it was like a light switching on. And I love it when I ever see anyone in the kitchen here and you go, they've fallen in love. You know what I mean? Because it's, for me... To have had a passion my whole life has been incredible. I love it as much as I did 35 years ago. I'm still as interested in it.
I think what's lovely about that story is that your first encounter was really the encounter that shaped your whole approach for life.
I always say to everyone in the kitchen or in a menu briefing, sometimes I go, we're so lucky because we get to give pleasure.
Yeah.
If we do what we do well and with care and attention, we tap into a sensory pleasure. Because food, to me, is all about it's all about memory. So in a funny way, the food that we hopefully create gives a beautiful pleasure or a memory to people.
Yeah.
I mean, and I think that's always in the simplest form possible. I mean, my definite, people always say to me, what's your kind of strongest food memory? And mine was in a... Having lunch with my father, he took me to a restaurant in Tuscany, just outside of Florence. And I hadn't long finished school. And at the end of lunch, they just brought to the table a bowl of shaved ice with just these perfectly ripe peaches.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember eating it, and it was hot. And you could see, it was really that kind of hot. And you could hear the noise, you know, that kind of summer noise of kind of, whether it be, it's just like wings, isn't it? I don't know what it is. And tiny little orchids in, I remember we'd gone for a walk and we'd seen all these wild orchids, and I ate this peach and it was so perfectly ripe and delicious. And I think actually, in a way, that was the first thing that ever happened, because I thought, my gosh, how do you beat nature when it is really perfect, when it is, what can I do except give it to you as a gift? I always feel like we have a chance to, you know, food is one element of a memorable meal, and I say that all the time. It's like, I am, it's how we greet you, it's how we see, it's how we make you feel, it's to make you feel welcome and loved and safe, and to facilitate beautiful conversation with your friends. And so for me, it's very experiential, the whole idea of sitting down at the table to a meal.
And so, Sky, if that's your professional philosophy, which I think you've described very beautifully, how did that play out as you evolved from one role to the next?
Well, I suppose, so I had, as I've described, I've had these kind of the ripe peach experience, and I had the amazing Layla Zorfi experience. And then, so I kind of had this preconception, and also the books that I'd read and the cookery books that I were reading at that period of time were, well, the very first book I ever had was Chapinese Cooking by Paul Bertolli and Alice Waters. There was a very kind of internal life of what I wanted to do, do you know what I mean? And I'm very much influenced by what Chapinese was doing and the generosity of spirit that Leila had given me and the kind of simplicity and beauty of produce in nature. And then it was kind of completely juxtaposed by the reality of what I experienced when I qualified and I went out into the work life. There was nowhere that I felt comfortable or at home or at ease. When I walked into Petersham in 2003, I knew Gail and Francesco Boglioni, and they said, will you come down? We've bought this nursery on the edge of the Thames, and we can have a cafe there without any restaurant license. Will you come and give us some advice about what we should do? I parked my car and I walked along the lane, St. Peter's Lane, and I came to these two gates, and there's a field in front with cows, and it's a sort of the Thames meanders, and it's an area called Arcadia, which is a conservation area, and it is so beautiful, just like tumbling off the edge of London, off Richmond Park. And I walked in, and it was still like running as an old nursery at that point. And it was almost like someone put a television screen as I walked into the gates, and I saw it all. And I thought, this is where all my hopes and dreams can collide. And I went and I had a conversation with them, and they were like, so what do you think, can we do it? And I was like, can I come and cook here for the summer? And they were like, sure. And I literally bought my pots and my pans, and it was this wooden kind of shed tacked against the southwest-facing wall of their garden. And it was a four-burner stove, and we just went and cooked. It was an amazing feeling when I just felt that, for the first time, it felt like everything, all the work I'd done kind of felt right. I remember when the first time I worked in the store with Leila, I felt like my feet were planted on the ground, and I felt in my body, and kind of all's right with the world somehow. And I felt that when I saw Petersham for the first time. And Judy, I really mean this when I say this. I've only just ever put my head down and worked and put one foot in front of the other. Yeah. I mean, in terms of a game plan, I'm probably not savvy enough to have that. So, I mean, for me, it's all about the intent and the work. And each day is about the work. I only see myself in this day, but it's about today's work. And I don't worry about what picture I'm creating so much or how people are perceiving me. I feel like, how can I be of value and use today?
You were lucky to find it, because a lot of people never find. But then perhaps you had a very clear idea of what that right place would look and feel like as a result of those very early experiences. Well, so you knew it when you found it.
I knew it when I found it. There is no such thing as luck. It's when preparation meets opportunity.
Yeah.
And I think that completely sums it up. And so today's work is my preparation for whatever may come ahead. You know what I mean? I'll do my best today. So all those years before Petersham, I'd cook at home the way I wanted to. I'd work with organic and farmers markets, and I'd read the books that I loved, and all in preparation. And then one day I stood outside the gates of Petersham, and it was like, where my preparation? And I saw the opportunity. And so and that's really what happened at Petersham. And then people responded in a kind of a really lovely way that obviously what I love, other people liked as well. But I also have to say that that was a creative relationship with Gail and Francesco Boglioni. I don't want to take all of the credit for that. I think it was a very symbiotic relationship, and I think you can't separate one from the other in terms of, I don't think we could have done it without each other.
Separately. Yeah, you were exactly the right people to be working together.
Yeah.
And Skye, I should mention the Michelin star, because you're famous for having been awarded a Michelin star and for it having affected your perception of how the expectations of the diners changed.
Yeah.
Because it's an incredible accolade in your profession.
So I actually got the news from a journalist standing in the queue of a bank one morning. I really couldn't even absorb the news when he said, how does it feel about getting a Michelin star? I'm like, what? Mm-hmm. You know, like, are you sure? And, you know, I trained in Paris. So in many ways, it was even more of a big deal for me because I trained in the 1980s, and that was the time of the great French chefs. So Roger Verger was still cooking, Paul Bocuse was still cooking. So, of course, as a little, you know, young cook in Paris, the idea that if someone said to you one day you're going to get a Michelin star, it would be like telling an 11-year-old girl once one day you're going to be a princess. I was very aware of the accolade, and I was so proud for everybody who worked at Peachim, and I was really proud that we'd stuck to our guns and just did what we did, and we were rewarded for being ourselves. That was an amazing feeling. And it was very important to me, make no mistake, and I was incredibly thrilled by it. The thing that became hard for me and was challenging was people's perceptions of what a Michelin star restaurant was, even 8 years ago. You know, it was us with a dirt floor and Wellington boots and outside loos that were unisex and Calagas, not even on mains gas. So people would come and they'd go, call yourself a Michelin-starred restaurant? And we were like, no, we didn't. We became on the back foot and all the kind of the reservations went crazy, and we were a tiny restaurant. It was so basic, the infrastructure of Peachim, and it never became any more complicated, almost from day one. We got a couple more stoves and we made a kitchen porter area. But I mean, really, we were cooking in a very basic way. And so actually, we couldn't cope with what happened to us when the star came. And actually, the thing was that I didn't leave because of Michelin star, and I've heard people say, oh, you left because you couldn't deal with the Michelin star. I couldn't achieve anything more there. It was 9 years, and it wasn't as fun anymore. It's like, wow, I just can't cook in an unfettered, you know, purely instinctual way anymore. I'm cooking to a kind of mold and a type, and it didn't give me as much pleasure, and I thought, I want to challenge myself to do something different. And that's why I left.
And so what happened?
So I left. And I didn't honestly have a clue what I was going to do. And
So that's scary to walk away.
Well, it was a weird few years because I'd separated from my youngest daughter's father, and I found myself with two girls, one quite early teens and one almost finishing her teens, and downsized and moved into a different house. And my whole life was really, really changing. And
how old would you have been then?
I was probably 45.
Yeah.
And I also had never been particularly responsible or a grown-up in the outside world. Like, I'd been a worker, but I hadn't necessarily even paid my parking. I'd never really paid my own mortgage or, you know, because I was always in a relationship, and I was quite happy to not deal with any of that stuff, or particularly even open the post. So I had this really big learning curve where I had to be a grown-up at 45 all of a sudden. That was one of my greatest moments of self-esteem. I had to learn to take care of myself. Each time I did something, like when I did get that parking permit, I felt terrific. And so as I kind of looked at my life financially, which I'd never really properly done, that for me was this huge final puzzle. It sounds weird, like the creative and the work life, I had gotten a confidence in, but I wasn't 100% sure I could look after myself fully. And so as I did that and I thought, I can do this, I felt so powerful in a different way for the first time. And that was really important to me. But I did leave Peachim with 2 months' mortgage in my bank account. And I didn't know what I was going to do. And I think that was a moment of insanity, but it was the best insanity. I just took a huge leap of faith. It was literally like jumping off a mountain, not knowing where I was going to land.
And you did have skills that you could parlay into an income.
Yes, but I didn't take that for granted. I was hoping that I could find an investor, and I really wanted a restaurant of my own, completely of my own. I knew I didn't want to work for anybody. And I
That's quite a big thing for a lot of women. They just get to a point where they say, I've done this, but now I want to do it on different terms. I want to have more control, and I want to have a stake in a business. I think that's quite an important thing, don't you?
Well, I think I needed a stake in something. Yeah. I needed to secure my future and my children's future, and I was very aware of that. I wanted to own something that hopefully could give me some security when I was older.
Mm.
So that was on my mind. I wanted to do it on my own terms. That was very on my mind. I didn't want to compromise, and I didn't want to be beholden to anyone.
Mm.
Of course, you are beholden to investors, but on a day-to-day basis. And I knew that I would work 120%. I mean, yeah. I always say it in the kitchen, and I believe this with all my heart, it's really easy to be successful in life. Give 100%. Most people give 40%.
Yeah.
And that is my true experience. If you work as hard as you can and you put everything into everything, and every single day, I say, my bar is perfect. And I say it to everyone in the kitchen and in the restaurant, it's easy. We do perfect. Anything under perfect, we're not succeeding.
I think often women are judged for being this way, but it fits your environment that you're creating and everyone's participating with you, then you can set that bar. In this environment, you can say, this is how I like it to be, because this is how I quantify success.
It probably sounds awful, but it isn't a democracy here.
Mm.
It's my vision. And I feel like I've worked really hard, and it's really important that that vision is maintained. And so we can sit around a table and discuss things, which we do, but ultimately the final say has to be mine.
Mm.
Because this is completely my vision, mm. and I have to hold on to that, and I'm fiercely protective of that.
Mm.
So I can't deviate.
It's not just your vision though, Skye, it's your name and reputation. It's everything that you've worked for to this point.
But you know, the thing is, it is my vision and it is everything I've worked for, and it probably is my reputation. But more importantly than that, I genuinely feel incredibly honored that people would come and visit us. So my level of perfection is about giving you the experience that you've so kindly agreed to come and eat with us. We can't let you down.
Mm.
If I overcooked a piece of veal and it was just like, oh, and I turned around to someone in the kitchen and went, oh, that's overcooked, but next time do it better. How much have I shortchanged you?
Mm.
Who's paying a lot of money to have things? So it's like, I always say to everyone, we never, on every plate of food, we just don't let ourselves down, like, because we're not going to let you down. And that's about building return custom. It makes good business sense to me as well.
But it goes to the heart of your whole approach to what you do and your philosophy about how you want to engage with the people who have invested in you.
Yeah, I want you to have the pleasure of a Mario Bellini glass on your table. I want you to have the pleasure of a beautiful Petit Four or a Mulberry tea that's just perfectly. I don't want to give you a Mulberry tea that's overstrained. You know, we've set out to create a beautiful restaurant where the food is, we are bloody well going to deliver it to you.
Mm. Yeah.
And that's how I feel.
Yeah. And so this is, we're now talking about Spring, the restaurant in Somerset House that was renovated very beautifully by you, with your sister Bryony, who has also been on the podcast, and it is beautiful. And to me, the first thing I thought when I walked in here for the first time was that there's a woman in charge here. This speaks to not a girly aesthetic, but a very elegant, refined female aesthetic. And I know that while it's not exclusively female here at all, you have a lot of women working with and for you to realise your vision for the restaurant. Do you feel that that is a point of differentiation? Do you feel that that brings a different quality to the way this restaurant operates?
Yes. I mean, I think we looked for over 2 years for a space, and I really wanted something incredibly beautiful. And I think for a second act, which is what Spring was, it had to be completely different from Petersham, because that it wouldn't be honouring Petersham or the Bolognese to repeat what I'd done. I wanted to do something completely, this is more my aesthetic than Petersham ever was. Actually, I'm much cleaner, sparer, with more air and space around everything. Although I love the Petersham aesthetic, but
But I like that about this, that it is so different from Petersham, and that you were able to take what you learnt at Petersham and then change direction and go for something very ambitious, very beautiful, very aesthetically pleasing in every sense. It is a sensual experience coming here. isn't it?
I wanted it to be a reflection of me. It's a big 24-foot high ceilings. It's in the West End. There's a lot of restaurants here that are sort of clubby with brown leather and do that kind of, that English kind of male clubhouse.
Clubby thing.
Yeah. And I wanted it to be a reflection of women are in charge here. Mm. I didn't want it to be girly. Obviously, as you said, I wanted it to feel like something that was very female, very ethereal, but also strong. Because I feel very female. I identify with women. Honestly, if I'm being very honest, my friendships are more with women. And I wanted it to reflect that. And I feel, I say it to the, I think women are so amazing, you know, and I think women are so incredibly capable. And sometimes we never get to see that in ourselves. And I always say that to my girls, actually. I want you to know how incredible you are, because we are. I mean, I'm constantly amazed how women can multitask, and the strength of women in work is quite, they can be very difficult as well. I'm not saying it's all plain sailing and I just want to work with women. I think definitely we need male energy. I don't want an all-female kitchen. It doesn't work so well. You know, we're the yin and yang of each other, aren't we?
But you are a woman confident enough to express yourself as a woman, as opposed to a woman who feels that she has to be more masculine in order to succeed. You've and truly got that sorted, Sky.
I understand my power. Mm. And that I don't mean that in an egotistical way. But I understand the female power, and I feel incredibly comfortable in it.
And so how do you nurture that sense in the women, and especially the young women who work with you, or even with your daughters? Like, how do you nurture that or impart your own strength?
I think probably if you ask the girls, my girls at home, I think sometimes they would say I was quite tough. Mm. I never mean to be. I can push them, because I think to have self-esteem, you have to do esteemable things. So you cannot sit around and hope to feel good about yourself. My feeling strong and powerful at my age, which is like I'm 56, so if I'm not going to feel it now, I'm never going to feel it. And I didn't always feel it. I think it's a combination of gently saying you can do something and encouraging them, go for it, do it. Sit with them if you want it, if they need to learn how to do something and go over an email with them or go over a kind of cooking technique with them, but then push them to do it. Because I think knowledge is power, repetition is power. Mm. So practice those things. That's been my experience, by turning up, by working with intent, by following a path that I believed in. I now can stand in with confidence. Mm. And so that's the only way I know how to do it. And then I think you create an environment that's loving, that's safe, that's nurturing. But I do demand a lot of people who work for me.
You've been more recently able to embrace some what I'd call social activism issues. You're very interested in food waste, and you now do this scratch menu, which I have had, which uses up the last of, so nothing is wasted. You believe in no plastic in the kitchen, and you've been able to transform your kitchen so that that is addressed. And I think I read somewhere that you said on reflection it was actually quite easy,
very easy
to do. You've been involved in feeding the homeless, biodynamic farming, and I know that you have a great affection and affinity for
Jane Scott Fern Vero,
who supply all of your organic ingredients to the restaurant. So you are almost evolving into a, I wouldn't call it a social activist, but these are all things that have the potential in a micro sense to affect the way you operate the restaurant in a positive way, but they're very big issues as well. Do you have a sense that you're constantly evolving to become more aware of the bigger world outside and how you can make a change here? Is Sky Gingell, in her third act, going to become Sky Gingell the activist?
So I think that everything's been a very natural progression for me in a funny way. I grew up in a macrobiotic family, which was about their idea of good food and nutrition. So I think that seed was planted, even though I rebelled against it. And then, obviously, I worked with a vegetable garden at Petersham, and I became quite involved with slow food and got to see the importance of maintaining culturally small producers, and then working with Jane, because the first thing I wanted to do, I wanted to work with Jane because I'd worked with so many vegetable gardener at Petersham, and I was in the middle of the West End, and I thought, you know, how can I feel a connection? How can I be inspired when I can't see, touch, feel? And then I really wanted to prove that we could make a viable business of this kind of, because everybody said it couldn't be done, and you have middlemen and food flown in from all over the world. And I thought, no, I want one tiny farm to basically supply most of our fruit and veg. And I want to make it so that they can make a living and we can make a living, because beautiful ideas must be viable. If they aren't viable, if they don't make economic sense, they aren't going to stay around. So everything that I try and do something with, I try and make sure it makes economic sense for the business, because otherwise it has no authenticity or longevity. It's not sustainable. That was the big thing I wanted to do when I came to Spring. So that's relationships at 5 years old. And then actually I came to food waste through that, because, you know, Jane had all these amazing seconds, and I worked out that we were probably wasting 30% of what the farm grew. And so how could we change that? And we could change that maybe through the scratch menu. And that led me on to looking at the bigger picture of food waste and realizing that over 40% of everything grown in this country, and actually pretty well between a third and 40% throughout the world, never makes a shop shelf, let alone gets wasted from the super, you know, that's just right at the beginning. And so I thought, how can we highlight that in a beautiful way? And it also worked because I'm quite controlling, and I gave the scratch menu to the young chefs, so they get to write a menu in a big restaurant, you know, without me interfering. Okay. So things have to make sense. And so that happened. And then I happened to go to a talk by a woman called Sian Sutherland from Plastic Planet. I heard about plastic. I went home and I watched a plastic ocean. I was completely horrified, and I thought, what can we do? And so we set out to go single-use plastic-free in January 2018. We did that through, and I got everybody on board. We all watched the documentary here. Sean came and spoke to us. We had ambassadors in the bar and the reception, and we have gone completely single-use plastic-free, which I feel good and proud about. But that's not enough, though. It's not enough in the world, for sure.
No, but I'm sure your own staff feel proud of that too. It's an aspect of running one of these businesses where they can feel proud.
And I definitely attract more like-minded people to work, and I think genuinely everybody does feel proud. We are, I think, probably the only single-use plastic-free restaurant in England, and we are all very proud of the work we do in maintaining a small farm. We're also really proud of, you know, they love writing the scratch menu. I could no more open this restaurant every morning, fly to the moon, without everybody here.
No.
So I need a team that's on board with me. And I suppose my vision at the end is the thing that we're, you know, but it's an inclusive vision, I hope. I'm also very, very aware that I'm not the sharpest tool in the box anymore in the kitchen. The kids are younger, they're faster, they're more energetic. Some of them are a lot better cooks than me. And I'm very interested in finding where my place is as I get older. And it's not necessarily standing for 14 hours a day in a kitchen any longer. I want to be in the middle of the bed. So I work to be in the middle of the bed, I suppose, you know, to keep myself relevant, because I want to be involved and engaged until the day I die. But I need to work hard to be that.
Yeah, but it makes life much more interesting too. And I think as a woman comes into full flower, feeling as though you have an interest that is important, it's great to feel like you're engaged as opposed to isolated. And in order to do that, you don't have to actually even have a job. You just need to be alert to what is important in the world that you want to occupy.
Well, you can't be passive. You have to be proactive. And I think that it is very important. I have to be brave enough to show up every day and do things in spite of my fear.
Yeah.
You know, because I'm obviously, you know, like there's lots of parts of my life that are not perfect and I definitely could work on and I feel fearful around. But I do know that I just need to show up and do the work. And the work is my passion. So I want to do it. And it's very fulfilling for me. And the way I feel now, I like feeling that way. I like feeling a kind of strength in myself. It makes me feel safe to feel strong.
But you are acknowledged as a leader, Skye. And I think being a female can sometimes help with that acknowledgement. you're seen as a leader in the culinary field and named with the big names in the culinary world. But it hasn't always been seamless, and I just want to touch on this issue. Mm. You don't get to your stage in life without setbacks, and I want to talk for a moment about the Sunday Times review that came out. I think you opened in October 2014, and this came out at the beginning of November.
Yeah.
So you just opened this new restaurant, a big investment of your time, energy, vision. You'd assembled a team in this important building, and this review came out, and it was absolutely devastating. Having said that, it was so shockingly a woman-on-woman attack of so many. I mean, the first thing she said was that Somerset House was an ugly building, and from there we went into all sorts of gynecological metaphors for your failures and all of this. It was just so reprehensible. But how, I want you to just talk about that for a moment, how shocking it was and how you dealt with it. Because I think women, you know, no life is fully formed and perfect, and this was a really important thing that happened to you.
You know you're going to get reviews on an opening. It's like opening a play. You know, the reviews are going to come. And you are on tenterhooks about them, and they are really important because you've put so much time, effort, passion, money into a project. And at the beginning, a good review is going to help you with your success. Mm. And so they're important. But actually, when I read that review, and it came out on a Sunday morning, someone rang me and said, the review's come out and it's really not good. And I remember reading it, and it literally felt like someone had thrown a cup of acid in my face. I could not believe that anybody could be so nasty.
I sort of didn't know how to respond. It was so shocking that it almost made me feel emotional. Not just critical, but also very, very personal. And I sort of sat there for like 5 or 10 minutes, and I just didn't know how to respond, really. And then I think I read it piece by piece, you know, like broke it down and read it bit by bit. I just couldn't agree with everything she said. Somerset House being an ugly bean counter of a building. She described these ceramic blossoms by Valeria Nascimento that we have on our wall as sodden, I think, menstrual tissues. It was almost so extreme that it probably had less of an effect on me if it was like, I would have been really devastated, to be honest with you, if I'd had that kind of, there are certain reviewers who I love and admire, like someone like Terry Jurak, for example, who really knows his stuff about food, and his criticisms are really, it's like being in a headmaster's office in a funny way, you know, and you'd actually sit up and take notes. This just felt like a kind of incredibly personal attack. I suppose the other thing, if I'm being very, very honest, I'd kind of probably sailed through my career without any sort of really negative press or bad reviews in terms of my food and what I did do. And so in a funny way, it was probably quite good for me, because I think it's good not to always hear good stuff. And I know that I'm not perfect, and I know that we get things wrong. But what happened, I think, which was so lovely for me, was so many people did rally around. People like Alex Shulman, ex-editor of British Vogue, wrote this really wonderful letter to the Times, and people went to Twitter and just said, look, hang on, you know, there's a review, and then this is just unfair and sort of below the belt. It was a painful period of time, but I think ultimately I felt incredibly supported by everybody, and so I was very comforted in that. And then I think that it's never bad to have something bad happen to you, is it? You kind of learn, and I learned that, you know, I can get through that and that it's okay. But, you know, isn't it funny? Like, if you'd asked me when it happened 5 years ago, I might have spoken about it very differently. So I'm talking to you now from my memory when everything becomes soothed and calmed down over time, doesn't it?
I love talking to Sky, and there are a few things I'd like to draw out of her interview for you that I think are especially pertinent to Unpaused. That early encounter with the woman who became her lifelong mentor, Leila Sorfi, I can't overemphasize how valuable it is to have that one person to come back to for reference,
especially through the ups and downs of a career. Second, the fact that she's never tired of being in the kitchen and learning about food really tells of a true vocation that has the space to accommodate stops and starts. She knew she was on the right path, and through different phases in her life, that path took several different forms. The point is, she kept moving forward. I love how Skye talked about how she finally mastered her own financial situation, something that a lot of women can relate to. And finally, how Skye has a really sound perspective on her career, her strengths, the importance of giving 100%, the value of the skills and experience that add up to preparation, with a capital P, for the big opportunity. I hope you enjoyed this episode in my new series of Unpaused. You can find Unpaused on Instagram and wherever you listen to podcasts. If you like the program and would like to review us on iTunes, I can't tell you how helpful that would be. Until next time, thank you to Leonie Marsh, my producer, and Claudia Cameron for research.